from a emotional, spiritual perspective, I was impoverished. And this ultimately fulfilled me and made me feel whole and made me feel connected. Because again, I changed the lens from which I saw the world to one recognizing that everyone is suffering, recognizing that everyone deserves love, recognizing that no one can understand what somebody is living through oftentimes, and we make assumptions which are often wrong. So if you have an open heart and you try to be as kind as you can be, it actually sets the stage for incredible interactions and opportunities to help others. At the end of the day, what this book is about is a way in which you can use your mind to change how you see the world and to change how the world sees you and how you have the power within yourself, the agency within yourself, to change your life to a life that you want, one that is deep, one that's long-lasting, and one that gives you the fulfillment and meaning that all of us want.
There is a deep conversation that can awaken our potential and stir our soul. A conversation that explores the possibility of living and loving as fully as we can. A possibility that begins with the practice of opening to life as we move through fear and make the conscious choice to pursue what matters most from a place of courage, wisdom, and love. I'm Joshua Steinfeld, and this is the Courageous Life Podcast. For decades, the practice of manifestation has been widely dismissed as self-involved, materialistic pseudoscience. Today, neuroscientist and founder of the Center for Compassion at Stanford, Dr. James Doty, is back on the podcast for the third time. And this time, we'll discuss what he calls an antithesis to the popular narrative around manifestation that narrowly emphasizes outward success and individual benefit. During our conversation, and in his new book, Mind Magic, The Neuroscience of Manifestation and How It Changes Everything, he invites us into a deep exploration about how our brains work and what happens when we pair their full power with the intention for a kinder, better world. What I appreciated so much about this book and the work Dr. Doty has done over his career is that he continues to offer evidence-based practices that can change the structures of our brain. Practices that harness the power of attention, meditation, visualization, and compassion. He argues that over time and with dedication, these practices can support us in moving through the world in ways that help us see clearly, reclaiming our agency, realizing our dreams, and reaching out to help others along the path. Here are a few highlights from today's episode. Jim will share why, as a starting point, it's important to reflect on what you've been manifesting in your life already. And after the reflection, a practice to shift what you're manifesting if you're not finding the fulfillment and meaning you've been yearning for. He'll offer some of his story of learning to manifest, including how and why his initial way of manifestation, which yielded quite a lot of material success, ultimately left him feeling empty and unfulfilled, insights into manifesting with an open heart, and practices that support doing so. He'll also offer some highlights from the neuroscience of manifestation, why cultivating calm and setting a compassionate intention lead to our brain's networks working at their full potential. He'll also offer insights about ways to work with mental barriers that can arise in this process, such as fear, shame, and doubt, how and why childhood experiences can influence our ability to practice manifestation, why manifestation isn't a quick fix, and why it's important to start small. And as we close out the conversation, I'll invite Jim to share a brief guided practice as a starting point for manifestation. If you find this conversation to be insightful, inspiring, or if it just piques your curiosity about the topic, I'd highly encourage you to check out his new book, Mind Magic: The Neuroscience of Manifestation and How It Changes Everything, which you can find wherever books are sold. Last but not least, I know for many of you, there may be no introduction needed to Dr. James Doty, but in case this is the first time you're coming across his work, here is a few highlights from his storied career. James R. Doty is a neurosurgeon and neuroscientist, as well as an adjunct professor at Stanford University. He also serves as the director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, CCARE for short. He serves on the board of a number of nonprofits and is the former chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation. He's also the host of the Into the Magic Shop podcast, which is also the title of his beloved and best-selling first book. For more on Dr. Doty, please visit jamesrdotymd.com or intothemagicshop.com. All right, I think that's about enough of an intro from me. Without any further ado, please enjoy this conversation with James Doty. All right. Well, James, welcome back to the show.
It's nice to be back with you, Joshua. It's good to see you. You're looking healthy.
Doing the best I can, you know,
As we all are.
So great to be with you. You've got another book coming out, Mind Magic. It's fantastic. I think I told you this during one of our previous conversations, but your first book, Into the Magic Shop, is the book I've gifted the most out of any book. And as you can imagine, I know you have your own podcast. I've read a lot of books for the podcast and a lot of, you know, really solid books out there, but yours stands out to me. Mind Magic is an incredible kind of follow-up. It's got a little bit of a different feel, but you have beautiful and inspiring stories in there. And the research is just breathtaking in a lot of ways and the themes to it. And yeah, I just found it to be a tremendous book. So congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. One of the challenges, I think, in writing books is how do you make the information accessible? And certainly neuroscience can get very complicated. And my goal was to, one, present an argument which is the antithesis of the traditional manifestation book, which is all about I want, I deserve, ask the universe, to one that makes people understand that the way we evolved as a species is to connect, to care, to be compassionate. And that's really what activates our brain in the best possible way. And the neuroscience is pretty clear that while anyone can manifest anything on some level, the challenge is understanding the difference between what you think you want and what you actually need. And unfortunately, in Western capitalist society, there's a false narrative that says to be happy is to be successful. Success requires money, wealth, position, power, and that's a dead end to unhappiness. Yet, because the way this is so promoted, and unfortunately, the way in which a lot of people who at least have fulfilled this narrative of success promote themselves, it makes so many people feel unhappy about where they're at, or a belief that if they just get that, they're going to be happy. And I'm sure you have a similar experience to mine. Many, many of those people are immensely unhappy. And the thing that fills the emptiness that they have is people looking at them and wanting to be like them. And it's very unfortunate. And this book is in many ways the antithesis of the narrative of the very popular book, The Secret.
Yeah, and I so appreciated that. And I want to dive into that further in just a bit. But I want to bring us to a way in, which is really looking at what I kind of drew out as the core of the book. And maybe it's like a driving reason why you wrote it. I'm not sure. We'll kind of find out. And I'd love to share, if you'll indulge me, a brief passage from the book.
I hope I remember it.
You write, "Within each of us is an incredible inner power that we limit by our own beliefs. It is the power to endure discomfort, to delay gratification, to decide what we let into our minds from our environment, and what we don't, to control our response to any given situation. This is the power of choice. And in reading particularly the earlier parts of the book, but I think all the way through, there's this real theme of agency and fostering a greater sense of choice and what leads to that. So even before manifestation, this felt like something that you were really trying to share with people, and not only share, but again, bring in research that's very supportive of how do we access this place of choice? How do we come back to this sense of agency, you know, in your words? So I'm curious if that lands for you as maybe a driving reason why you wrote the book, or kind of a foundational piece.
Well, it is a foundational piece. And I think there are a couple issues. One is all of us every day are trying to manifest. You know, you wake up and you say, I'm going to go for this interview. I really want this job. I hope this works out. And all of that's good. But what people don't understand, it's like any endeavor. To master it, it takes practice. Practice usually takes repetition. And as you know, there's this saying that what fires together, wires together. And in some ways, this is the nature of repetition, or this is the nature of what sports psychologists do in regard to visualization. What a lot of people don't appreciate is that throughout their lives, they have been collecting baggage, oftentimes from childhood experiences, and oftentimes this is negative. And also we have a negativity bias based on our evolution as a species, because negative things at least are interpreted as putting us at risk. So we're frequently attuned to those. And then what happens is oftentimes this negativity in other domains gets implanted within our minds and then becomes an ongoing conversation that says we're not good enough, we're not worthy, we don't deserve. And when you've grown up in environments where, especially during development, and as you know, there's a whole development or attachment theory, when you grow up in environments that are negative, as an example, if you have a parent who is physically abusive, and then they sit there and they hug you and say, I'm sorry, I love you, then you get this confusion as to what love is. And when I say people are already manifesting, oftentimes the baggage you carry is very powerful in terms of affecting every decision you make, every relationship you choose to be involved in. And this is why you see oftentimes people sit there and they go, I don't understand this. This is my third marriage and it's the same person. The person's abusive and an alcoholic. Why does this keep happening? Well, you have to back up and say, how did I get here? And in some ways, this is understanding what you're manifesting today. One thing is to become self-aware of that and understand how that affects you. And there are ways to get around that. And as you know, one technique is a mindfulness type of practice where you deal in some ways with that baggage, but you change the narrative from one of negativity to one of self-affirmation. And getting back to your question of agency, a lot of people, unfortunately, again, because of the nature of how we've constructed our society, keep looking for external affirmation to make them feel whole. The problem is that they're looking for something outside of themselves to change their lives or make them happy. And many times people give away their self-agency. And what I mean by that, I'm sure you've been in the situation where perhaps you had a goal, a dream, an aspiration, and you've, you know, expressed it. And you've had even family members say, oh, you're never going to do that. You can't do that. It's not possible. Sure. And how demoralizing, and especially with children. And this is how people get limitation in their beliefs. They believe that something is true. And I think Henry Ford said, if you say it's possible, that's reality. If you say it's impossible, that's reality. And so what this means is you have to have and develop a belief within the power you have within yourself. And there is no external entity that's going to make your life better. Now, that's not to say external events cannot make your life better, but there is no omniscient being worried about you or I. And so you have to understand within yourself, we have the ability to change our brains. We have the ability to change the neural pathways that stimulate different parts of our brain. And what you don't realize is there is so much power in that. When you have negative commentary about yourself, it's oftentimes like building a prison where you're placing every brick with a negative comment. and the walls get higher and it gets darker. And at some point, many people give up because they believe they have no power to change their life. But in many ways, the key out of that prison is to understand there is no external force. It is your choice, and you have much more power than you believe. And this is the concept of embracing your own self-agency. And as we know, we look at different individuals, and this isn't necessarily to say what they're doing is perfect in any way, but what it says is that you can change. As an example, if you look at Tibetan monks, they can do certain meditative practices where they can change their heart rate, their body temperature. You look at somebody in popular culture, Wim Hof, who has developed the ability to run in very cold temperatures. I think he tried to climb Mount Everest.
Like in shorts or something?
In shorts and bare feet. And, and now, certainly the average person, because he also probably has some genetics that allow him to do that. But he's done amazing things. And all of us have the ability to do amazing things. We just have to believe it. And so one of the aspects of this book is, one, to make people sort of understand where they've been and what they've manifested to date, and then make them understand that they have power within themselves to change their limited beliefs, to understand that they can do anything they wish.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think sometimes when that belief in one's own agency or that sense of agency isn't there, what you're talking about can sound hopeful, maybe aspirational, but sometimes like a bridge too far. It's like, well, how am I supposed to get there? And you write about this in working with this doubt, this fear, this sense of hopelessness. And you write, seeing our thoughts for what they are is the first crack in the illusion of our helplessness. So there's this piece, and you alluded to it earlier by talking about a mindfulness practice or an awareness practice where we start to become aware of our thoughts and start to see what they are. And part of this too, I think you mentioned, which is seeing that we have these patterns of conditioning, these ways of being in the world or what we've already been manifesting. But like any conditioning, they can be maybe deconditioned or reconditioned in new ways because of how our brain works. So if that idea of getting in touch with a sense of my own inner power seems like a great thought, but that seems pretty far away, can you share a little bit more about how we might work with some of that fear, some of that doubt, some of that helplessness? Anything you want to elaborate on there?
Sure. Well, one thing that people may not appreciate is your brain is lazy, and oftentimes it chooses the status quo. So you have to understand that. So how do you get around that? One of the ways is manifesting things or rewiring your brain or changing your brain. It actually requires work, and you have to show up. And it's also something that you don't get 100% from day one. And this is this idea, if you will, of baby steps or tiny habits. And I'm sure you know B.J. Fogg and others who've written about this reality, that to rewire your brain, you have to start small. As an example, if you want to be a marathon runner, you don't wake up one day and run a marathon. And if you're particularly out of shape, you don't run a mile either. Mm-hmm. Your brain has to learn that it can do it. So it doesn't do it by you waking up, trying to run 26 miles and then failing at mile one and saying, this is hopeless, I can never do it. It gets conditioned and this habit gets embedded by simply waking up and taking the first step. And that's oftentimes the hardest for people, that very first step. The other thing is, as I said, your brain is reluctant to change because change is unknown. And frankly, change can be painful. But this is what you have to do. You have to make it become your friend. Now, I'll tell you as an example, I try to wake up at about 6 a.m. and I put my tennis shoes by the bed and the socks, and therefore I'm sort of conditioned to do that. But I will tell you every day I wake up and I go, God, I don't want to do that. And sometimes that doesn't go away. But once you've done it enough times, the motivator is you've done enough times and you get up as reluctant as you are. And you get your shoes on and you go outside and you start walking and then everything's okay. And you may sit there, and I live where there are a lot of hills. Mm-hmm. As I start up the hill, the first hill, I go, why am I doing that? But I keep going. And there's an interesting thing that David Goggins said, and I don't know if you know David Goggins. Ultra athlete. He says, you can always do 40% more than you believe. Mm. Now, I don't know if that's a true statement or not. Mm. But I have chosen it to be true. So every time I sit there and get tired and say, I want to stop, I say, I know I can do at least 40% more. Mm. And then it keeps me going. Plus, I take my dog with me, and my dog is a jerk because he likes those walks. So if I either don't get up or don't do my part, he reminds me. And in some ways, this is like having responsibility to somebody. So each of those types of things can be very helpful in you taking that first baby step. But mm-hmm. again, like anything else, and it's almost a truism, you have to take the first step.
You've mentioned the words work a few times, and I just appreciated that about the book too. Like, this isn't necessarily a quick fix or a special pill we take and everything's all right. It does require work and discipline and what you're talking about and taking the first step. And you offer this beautiful 6-week program in the back of the book that outlines so many of these practices and steps we can work through to manifest. And one of those I also found interesting as we're talking about fear was this conversation you had in the book about the importance of getting into kind of a relaxed state or engaging the parasympathetic nervous system and how that relaxation response, that rest and digest, can really be supportive of the manifestation process. Can you talk a little bit about why that is so important?
Well, there are actually several parts of that. But what's interesting and what actually often holds people back is not the event itself or the action you wish to do. It is the fear of the action and the cost or the pain you're going to suffer. As an example, there's a lot of promotion of ice baths, right? And mm-hmm. you'll see some people sort of timidly go in and then they'll go, oh, what? And then they'll slowly go a little bit. Ah! And the thing is, they have this immense fear of actually the doing mm-hmm. versus if you're able to self-regulate and not get lost in that fear in advance, you can actually just step into it. Now, I'm not saying it's not cold, but it's a completely different response. Because for so many people, the event is not the problem, the fear associated with the event. And that sets off a whole lot of physiologic bells and whistles that activate the sympathetic nervous system, which of course is the flight, fight, or freeze response, and its associated negative physiologic effects. At least I say negative in the context of that event, because of course the sympathetic nervous system has allowed us to survive for millions of years. And, you know, 200,000 years ago, in terms of our DNA, we're the exact same as we were then. And so in that context, it's the same as we were on the savannah in Africa. A predator may walk through the grass, we see the grass move, and then our sympathetic nervous system kicks in and activates all these physiologic effects that allow us to escape and hopefully survive. But those are very short-lived. Unfortunately, in modern society, because we don't live in that way, many people's sympathetic nervous system is chronically activated with secondary negative consequences. But if you're able to move over and live predominantly in your parasympathetic nervous system, if you will, or this rest and digest system, many things happen. One, your reward centers are activated. You're more creative. You're more productive. These cognitive brain networks work at their best. And your physiology works at its best. Your heart rate is lowered. Your blood pressure is lowered. Your heart rate variability, which is a measure of engagement of your parasympathetic nervous system, is actually increased, which is a good thing. Your immune system is boosted. The production of inflammatory proteins is decreased. The excretion of stress hormones is decreased. So there are all these positive benefits when you're in that mode. And actually, it's when you're in that mode that you have the maximal ability to manifest. Now, what some people get confused about is, and we're talking about work on some level, mm-hmm. it's not you just sit there in a chair and go, okay, I want the universe to make my life better. Okay, I did it. Mm-hmm. And you know what the first sentence of the book is.
Yes, I do. I won't spoil it. It's so great. So great. Yeah.
But That's the truth. There isn't some outside agent that decides whether you're good or bad or that you deserve or anything. That power strictly is within you. And that's why, and this is throughout history, through a whole variety of quotes from very prominent or famous people, the only person who can make you happy is you. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what your circumstances are. Epictetus, who was a Stoic philosopher and a former slave, he said, I cannot control my external circumstances, but what I can do is control how I react to them. And this is why you see someone from a very humble background who you or I or somebody may look at and go, God, their life is horrible. I wouldn't want to be like that. Yet they're beaming, they're happy, they're joyful, they're thankful. Then you see somebody who walks out of their $10 million house into their Ferrari and they sit there and go, God, life sucks. You know, this is horrible. How can people live like this? You know, I have to do this and I have to show up at this meeting. And again, it is extraordinary how simply your attitude or your belief in the world changes not only how you interact with the world, but frankly, how the world interacts with you.
And I think part of this too is what you mentioned earlier, which I really appreciated in the book, this conversation about the importance of moving beyond yourself when it comes to manifesting. I just love your writing, so I really want to honor it and bring it in and just share a quick passage here. You wrote, I looked down at the cigar box, holding my cherished objects. My heart clenched at the realization that despite all the things I'd managed to accumulate, in a sense, this thin 12-inch box contained everything I had ever truly possessed. A person can't possess more than they can love. And I had not opened my heart any wider than when I first wrote my list. So coming back again to the idea that you expressed at the opening, which is part of the manifesting that you're talking about, is coming from a place of love, of service, or contribution to others, to our communities, of doing good in the world. So maybe we can use that as a segue into talking about what manifesting is and what it isn't.
As you can see, I always get emotional. when I was a child, and this relates back to my first book, Into the Magic Shop, where I met this woman, Ruth, who taught me a meditation or mindfulness or mind training practice, but she also taught me the basics of manifestation. And as you know, oftentimes in our culture, wrapped around woo-woo and pseudoscience, is this idea of manifestation. And the narrative typically is, if you use the law of attraction by putting out positive thoughts from the universe will come back and give you what you want. And there are a couple problems with that, and some we've alluded to. The first is that oftentimes, if you don't get what you want, there is a sort of shaming that, well, you didn't really want it bad enough. And nothing could be further from the truth. The other aspect is that the narrative is about you. I want this. I want that. If I get this, it's never about, I want to do this to be of service. And the reason that's important is when you look through the lens, and this is the case often, people who are focused on what I want, it's through insecurity, shame, fear, scarcity. And the very nature of that actually activates your sympathetic nervous system. And that limits actually how these cognitive brain networks interact. And so it actually decreases the likelihood of you manifesting something. Getting back to your statement about the parasympathetic nervous system and engaging that. So when I made my list, when I was with Ruth, when I was 12, frankly, I had no self-awareness as a child and growing up in poverty, I bought into this notion that I need these things to make me whole, to make me feel good about myself. And I made a list. And that list included living in a mansion, having $1 million, driving a Porsche, having a Rolex. Part of it was becoming a doctor. Now, that goal originated from a fourth grade professions visit at my school where I met a physician who was very kindly and very nice. And I said, right then, I want to be a doctor. But I included that on my list, and I accomplished every one of those things. Yet, at the top of every one of these mountains, I kept waiting to feel whole. And there was nothing there. I mean, I had people go, hey, great job, Jim, but it didn't fill me with anything. And I kept saying, well, if I just do one more thing, that'll make it happen. And it never did. And here I am. I have a multi-million dollar home overlooking the bay in Newport Beach that's 6 or 8 bedrooms, I can't remember, of which I'm the only inhabitant at this point. I have a penthouse, which is 4 or 5 bedrooms at the top of a building in San Francisco. I have my own garage that I go into, my Porsche, my Ferrari, and I had never been more miserable my entire life. Yet I had all my friends going, God, Jim, you're rocking, man. Look at what you're doing. This is fantastic. And I felt nothing. And the problem was that I was confusing what we call hedonic happiness or hedonism, which is a desire to get maximal pleasure with minimal pain. And that oftentimes is through things. And I was acquiring all of these things, and I kept acquiring more, thinking if I just get one more of these things, I'll be whole. I'll be okay. My shame, my insecurity will go away. And what I found was ultimately that that feeling was shallow and transitory. Versus if I looked out and said, how can I be of service? How can I improve the lives of others? That actually resulted in a completely different narrative. And I felt good. And what I realized, reflecting on my own experience, and I'm sure you probably had a similar experience, when you have reached out and helped somebody who was struggling, those memories are deep, long-lasting, and I'm sure it may be years, and you think about them, though, and you get this sense of warmth and feeling good. And the reason is that as we evolved as a species, our offspring is very small. And unlike other species, we have to care for our offspring for well over a decade, which requires us to be present both in time and also an immense amount of resources. Genetically, we have an imperative to do that because when we do that, our reward and pleasure centers are stimulated and our physiology works its best. And as a result, if you look at how people survived in these blue zones, as an example. What happens is that we realize that this is a group of people who predominantly live in their parasympathetic nervous system engagement, which means they connect with people, they're open, they're generous, they're thoughtful, they share. And the reason is that people in that environment frequently are born in that village, typically a small village, they die in the village. They have multi-generational families who they live with, siblings, parents, grandparents, and the community supports them. They care about them. They know their strengths. They know their weaknesses, and they still love them. They're not judging them. Those types of environments are places where people typically live to be over 100. Because when you're in that mode, everything about your physiology works much better, including your cognitive brain networks. And we were evolved to care. And while there may be a million cookbooks about the Mediterranean diet, the most important thing, which has been proven through the Harvard Adult Development Study, which frequently is called the Longevity and Happiness Study that's been going on for 85 years, it is social connection, depth of relationships that have the greatest aspect in terms of extending our lives and making us have happy lives. And therefore, instead of looking at through the lens of hedonic happiness, you have to look through the lens of eudaimonic happiness, purpose and meaning. Purpose and meaning comes from connecting with other people, having depth of relationships. When you do that, your physiology works its best, your cognitive brain networks work their best, and as a result, this is how you have the greatest likelihood to manifest. But the other interesting component is, and I've said this in the first book, and I think I also alluded to it in this book, which is when you change how you look at the world changes how it looks at you. And also, when you look at the world through that different lens, you realize the things you thought you may have wanted aren't really what you need. And that changes everything. And now, when I talk about some of these things, people somehow think I'm disparaging materialism and perhaps promoting socialism. Now, I'm not opposed to socialism or social democracy because we've created an environment in Western capitalist society of some narrative that people who aren't making it, it's their own fault, which is not true at all. In fact, it's because the social safety net or the responsibilities that should be within all of us and in terms of the government, which should not be run like a business, should be to care for our communities. But regardless, when you are in this mode, you realize that actually you don't necessarily need that car or that big house. Now, I was losing track here, so forgive me. But what I was trying to ultimately say was that there's nothing wrong with having these things. And I've been very fortunate and successful in that context. But here's the big difference that separates the two. And I will tell you, I drive a Porsche and I live in a very nice house and I live very well. But the difference is that if all of those things were gone tomorrow, it would have zero impact on anything in my life. It would not make me unhappy. It would not make me feel as if I'm not able to manifest or that I'm a failure at all. It is the attachment and craving which causes so much suffering. As if, oh, it's taken away, my life is ruined. Oh, it's taken away, I don't get to go to this party or this event, or people are going to judge me because of that. This is where you have to let go of attachment and craving because it's going to make you miserable. There's nothing wrong with acquiring things and enjoying them, but you can't get lost in that and not care about other people or how other people's lives are or contributing to the greater good of the world. And when you do that, you are able to manifest almost anything, or I should rephrase it and say, if it is possible to manifest it, utilizing that worldview or that perspective causes the greatest likelihood for that to happen. That's not to say it will happen. It's not to say it will happen in the time frame you want or that it will happen exactly the way you want. But when you're in that mode, when you're looking through the lens of caring, compassion, thoughtfulness, openness, that is when your parasympathetic nervous system is engaged. That's when these cognitive brain networks work at their best. And that is therefore the greatest likelihood for you to manifest your dreams or your intentions.
Thank you so much for sharing more of your story. And personally, I can share with you, which you know, is, you know, once you shifted your what you were manifesting and focused more on serving the greater good and coming from a place of compassion and continuing to open your heart and coming back to that practice, you founded the Center for Compassion at Stanford, which you shared the story of during one of our previous interviews. And I've been through the 8-week training there. And I got certified to teach that training. And so I am just so grateful to you for, you know, creating and having the vision to bring that forth in the world and it allowing me to do much of the work that I care about to really serve. So thank you for that. And one of the things too I appreciated in the book as we're talking about this is you just being so vulnerable and human, just sharing your humanity. And you sharing in this moment in time where you had this kind of realization that everything I really possessed was in this little box because I hadn't opened my heart wide enough. There was a reflection in there about when we engage in a certain practice for a period of time and we get really good at it, which you did. You got really good at manifesting the things that you wanted. They were on that list. You named them. You knocked them out. So you got really good at it. We can... And I'll just speak for myself, I can sort of lose the same sort of motivation or diligence about the practice and be like, oh, I got it. I got that. And not engage in that kind of daily repetition that matters. And I'm curious about you. You mentioned that in the book, and then you mentioned about coming back to your own practice of opening the heart and expanding the heart. Could you share a little bit about what that looks like for you now?
Sure. Well, what I realized ultimately, and again, just to reiterate some aspects to give clarity, I was doing very well to the point of the dot-com crash. I had all of these things. And in 6 weeks following the crash, I lost close to $80 million. I was $3 million in the hole. I had an outstanding loan to the bank for $15 million. And what I tell people in those situations, you get two close friends. One's your banker who wants his money, and the other's your lawyer who helps you to get out of this mess. And during this period of time, in some ways, I sat down and I said, what did I do wrong? And I went back to actually this mansion I have overlooking or had overlooking the bay in Newport Bay. And here I am sitting there, and it's beautiful, except it's devoid of almost all its furniture. And through that reflection, I realized all the actions I were engaged in or had been engaged in were based on my own insecurity and my own shame and trying to overcome the narrative that poverty had created in my head, that I was never going to be enough until I had enough money or enough power, enough position where I would feel secure. And after spending a lot of time dealing with this and reflecting on this, when I realized this was in many ways the antithesis of what Ruth was trying to teach me, then I got clarity. And it wasn't that Ruth was wrong. It's just that I was 12 years old and had no self-awareness or understanding. And the thing that always loomed over me was poverty. And when you come from poverty, you have a false belief that if I just get money, all my problems are solved. And this is what we see with lottery winners oftentimes. You see so many of them, it creates disaster in their lives and it ruins their lives. And many have said, you know, winning the lottery was the worst curse I ever had. And many of them, the money's gone within a year. So money is not the solution. And I realize this. And what I tell people is I went from rags to riches, literally. Then I went to rags with the dot-com crash. But then I got untold riches. And what I mean by that is that I started the center at Stanford, which you alluded to, which studies the neuroscience of compassion and has developed a variety of techniques and interventions to help people learn compassion and be self-compassionate. But also it resulted in me meeting the Dalai Lama. He became the founding benefactor of the center. I ultimately became the chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation. He and I became friends. As a result of that, it allowed me to meet a large number of the most prominent spiritual and religious leaders in the world. And whether that's the Pope, Sadhguru, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, Amma the Hugging Saint, Eckhart Tolle, Byron Katie, I became friends with these people. And I will tell you, being in the presence of elevated spiritual leaders is profound because they give you unconditional love, which is what all of us want. And in the presence of somebody, it calms us down. We feel loved. We don't feel that we have to put on an act. We can be ourselves because all the stuff that has happened, all the stuff we've done that has been bad or negative, it's irrelevant. And that is truth in general. Most people, unfortunately, because of their egos or what they've been conditioned, are not able to give that to another person. And that's very hard. But until you're able to be authentic, until you're able to be open and honest, on some level, you're going to suffer. So what happened ultimately was when I was dealing with my lawyers, they had informed me that a donation I had made to charity of stock in a company that hadn't gone public, they did not file the paperwork and that I could not do it. And I could have all of that stock. And here I am, $3 million in the hole, having to sell everything. And obviously, it was tempting to do that. But after this period of reflection, I told the attorney to go ahead and give it all away. And that ended up being about $30 million. And it allowed me to set up health clinics around the world and programs for the disabled, programs for individuals with AIDS, HIV, fund research, set up scholarships, endow chairs. And ultimately, that also allowed me to meet all these spiritual and religious leaders. So when I say, I went from rags to riches to rags, but I went to riches, but in a different way. Now, I will preface this by saying when I went from rags to riches to rags, I was a neurosurgeon. So I was still paid more than 99.9% of people. So I would not want anybody to feel sorry for me. But from a emotional, spiritual perspective, I was impoverished. And this ultimately fulfilled me and made me feel whole and made me feel connected. Because again, I changed the lens from which I saw the world to one recognizing that everyone is suffering, recognizing that everyone deserves love, recognizing that no one can understand what somebody's living through oftentimes, and we make assumptions, which are often wrong. So if you have an open heart and you try to be as kind as you can be, it actually sets the stage for incredible interactions and opportunities to help others. But as His Holiness has said, if you want others to be happy, be compassionate. If you want to be happy, be compassionate. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, what this book is about is a way in which you can use your mind to change how you see the world and to change how the world sees you and how you have the power within yourself, the agency within yourself, to change your life to a life that you want, one that is deep, one that's long-lasting, and one that gives you the fulfillment and meaning that all of us want.
Beautiful. Jim, thank you. I think, you know, we just have a few minutes left here. I want to acknowledge one thing and then ask you for a closing practice, I guess, to invite you to share a closing practice potentially. The thing I'd love to acknowledge is in the beginning of the book and at a couple of different points throughout the book, you acknowledge manifestation not being a magic fix-all for obviously everything, right? And there are forces at play, whether it's systemic oppression or racial injustice or different circumstances that people are facing in their environments that can be extremely challenging, that maybe manifestation does not, that just doesn't solve in a certain way. So I really appreciated the conversation that you brought in about that, because I think in some other discussions about manifestation, which you named kind of the popular culture idea of manifestation, that often doesn't get addressed, at least in my speak for myself and my experience of it. So you naming that was very appreciated. And I think the closing piece that I'd love to invite you to share is, if I was to sit down with you and just begin this manifestation process, and we just had a few minutes here together, what might be the advice or instructions, guidance that you'd offer me as a way to start out?
Well, of course, one of the most important things is to calm the mind. And of course, if you look at traditional mindfulness practices, which I utilize here, one of the first things is simply to sit. Now, a lot of people confuse these types of practices with you having your legs crossed and your fingers up like this, and you don't need any of that. All you need to do is to sit, or you can stand, or you can even lay down and just slowly start breathing in and exhaling. Just do that slowly for 4 or 5 breaths. And as you do that, and this may seem strange, is to think of that person, which commonly is one's mother, but to think of a person who has cared for you and loved you, and just hold that image or that feeling with you and just slowly breathe in and out. The very nature of doing that immediately shifts you over to engagement of your parasympathetic nervous system, but it also gives you this sense of calmness and love for yourself, which allows you to be able to give that love to others. Because unless you're able to love yourself, unless you're able to recognize, no matter what your past is, no matter what you've done, you still deserve love. And so being able to sit with that and hold that feeling is extraordinarily powerful. And it sets the stage for you to be accepting of yourself, and also to align those brain networks, if you will, so that they will be attuned for you to embed your intention and manifest what it is that will change your life.
Jim, it's always such a pleasure to sit with you. Thank you for being here, for sharing your wisdom. The new book is incredible. I'd highly encourage people to go pick up their own copy, to share it with friends. The list goes on. Congratulations on that. If people want to follow you, find out more about your work, the podcast, anything you're offering, where's the best place for them to do that?
You can go to jamesrdodiemd.com, which lists pretty much all the stuff that I do. The programs at Stanford, you can find at CCARE, CCARE.stanford.edu. Actually, I have been working on a mental health app which uses actually artificial intelligence and a human-like avatar, which at least so far seems to be very, very effective in helping people as a mental health companion. And that's called Happy, HAPPI.AI. And let's see, where else? Oh, my podcast is called, shockingly, IntoTheMagicShop.com /podcast. And like you, there have been some very fascinating, interesting people who people can learn from, gain insights from, and hopefully it offers people a whole variety of different ways to look at the world and to change their lives in a positive direction.
Wonderful. Thank you so much again, Jim. Really appreciate you being here.
Oh, no, thank you. Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Courageous Life. I'd like to extend special thanks, as always, to my executive producer, Matt Donner, for all of the incredible behind-the-scenes work he does to make this show sound great. He's also responsible for composing the original music that you hear at the beginning and the end of every episode. Also, if you're enjoying the show and the conversation, please do share with friends, because I believe that courage is contagious. And while you're at it, if you happen to be on iTunes, make sure you click the subscribe button, or if you feel so compelled, leave a positive review. It encourages me to keep going and also helps others to find a valuable show amidst the many podcasts that are out there. Until next time, this is Joshua Steinfeld with The Courageous Life.